SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a 3D live video journal, which is interactive with discussion, and now offers this program and others on podcasts on Apple, Amazon, and Spotify. In association with SNI, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, are pleased to present another in the SNI Digital series of interviews with clinical neuroscience leaders. This program will be a discussion with Rafael Tamargo about an updated review of open microsurgical versus endovascular management of unruptured and ruptured brain aneurysms. Dr. Tamargo is the Walter E. Dandy Professor of Neurosurgery, the Director of the Division of Cerebral Vascular Neurosurgery, the Vice Chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery, and the Neurosurgical Co-Director of the Neurosciences Critical Care Unit at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. The paper he'll be discussing in this program is Open Microsurgical versus Endovascular Management of Unruptured and Ruptured Brain Aneurysms, published in Operative Neurosurgery in November of 2024. The discussion will include Eric Nussbaum, who's the chair of the National Brain Aneurysm and Tumor Center and the director of Complex Cranial Neurosurgery and the Midwest Spine and Brain Center in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota, and the associate editor-in-chief of SNI and board member of SNI Digital. Dr. Nussbaum has published a number of books and scientific papers in PubMed and SNI. These books on aneurysm and AVM surgery are available at Amazon.com and from Theme Publishers at Theme.com. Also in this discussion is James I. Ousman, so yes. Why don't you
absolutely
start?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I would like to thank my old friend and mentor, Dr. Ousman, for inviting me to speak and for Surgical Neurology International to give me this opportunity. Dr. Ousman asked me to give a brief synopsis of my background. I was born in Cuba and grew up in the Caribbean, mostly Puerto Rico. I went to Princeton University for college, Columbia University for medical school, and then I did 1 year of general surgery at Columbia Presbyterian, and after that moved to Johns Hopkins, where I did my residency in neurosurgery, and I've been there since then. I got to Hopkins in 1985, and my focus has been vascular neurosurgery. I do open neurosurgery. I have never done endovascular, but I have a great team, and we all work together. And I've been at Hopkins since then. And so today I would like to talk about currently how we think about treating aneurysms, whether we treat them endovascularly or microsurgically.
So why don't we just start with we'll get into the various aneurysms. It's pretty straightforward. But to me, the big issue is some of the statistics you were talking about. And you talked about a microsurgical clipping versus coiling, and that the rebleeding rate after clipping is lower than coiling.
Yes. I
got some questions about that to you. Okay.
Yeah. So
the problem. I have a problem. I'm Eric. I want you to jump in here. I have a problem comparing clipping, which we've done for decades, with coiling, which we started in, because we did it started in the 90s, so it's about 25 years or 30 years maybe. And people haven't done the kinds of follow-ups angiographically that we did clipping or that we were forced to do. For example, the mortality rates or the complication rates, they define as the first 24 hours. In surgery, we define it as the first 7 or 30 days. So
Yes.
you can't compare apples to oranges. And they say, well, look, my reblading rate or complication rate in 24 hours was 0.1 or some very low figure. Well, I was in a conference where they did that, and 3 days later, the patient ruptured, and that was coiled.
Yes.
So
Yes.
the question is, you cited the rebleeding rates, which were lower with clipping than they were with coiling. Are those reliable, or are they actually worse in because of the data I mentioned?
Well, so the rebleed rates, so at this point, basically, we have 30 years of experience with endovascular techniques. You know, the technique was the coils, and then the pipeline was introduced, and then most recently the web. There are many others, but basically, we have data on the 10-year follow-up, 10-year follow-up for coils, pipeline, and web, and there is no question that the rebleed rate is higher in coiling, for instance, and we know that from primarily the BRAT trial at Barrow, where, you know, outstanding microsurgeons and outstanding endovascular treatment, you know, neurosurgeons treated the aneurysms, and the bleeding rates were higher. The problem with the bleeding rate is that, as you point out, it takes a long time to acquire that information. With the ISAT trial, the GDC trial, by the time they published their 10-year results, three times the number of aneurysms had bled in the endovascular group as opposed to the microsurgical group. So, looking at bleeding rates is not good because it takes a long time for that to happen, and the follow-up has been different. So, what is the best way to assess the techniques at this point is looking at the retreatment rates, because for someone to, you know, treat an aneurysm either surgically or endovascularly, and then have to go back and tell the patient, "Listen, I'm so uncomfortable with what's going on that I think we need to retreat it." It takes a lot for that to happen, and if you look at the retreatment rates, then we start to compare the two, and we can have a similar you know, similar data for the different techniques. And when you look at that, if you look at ISAT and BRAT for GDCs, you see that at 2 years, the retreatment rate for GDCs in ISAT was 17%. And then at 10 years, BRAT had a retreatment rate of 20%. And the comparable rate for microsurgery for those, you know, in those studies is about 3%. But then people said, well, you know, the coils are a thing of the past. We now have the pipeline. But then with the pipeline, we have solid 2-year data, and the retreatment rate for pipeline is 8%, and then at 10 years, the retreatment rate for pipeline is about 18%, and web is not doing well. You know, basically at 3 years, the retreatment rate was 11%, and the 5-year rate is 18%. So, knowing that, it's clear that the endovascular techniques seem to have a biological barrier. And I think that it may be because without really having thought this, with clipping, we bring the normal edges of the intima together and then it can heal. But with the endovascular techniques, those remain open. At this point, if things continue at this rate, we see that the endovascular techniques have had a recurrence, a retreatment rate of 18 to 20% at 10 years. And if we, I have worked out a model with a correction, and I estimate that at 20 years, the retreatment rate for endovascular aneurysm is going to be about 26%, and at 30 years, it's going to be about 30%.
Now
So,
let's stop
yeah.
you for a minute. Those
Yeah.
are astounding figures. Do you have police protection after this talk? Because I'm sure the instrument companies are not going to come after you. Eric, do you have any thoughts about this? I always thought that this was a very underestimated figure. What's your experience? What's your thinking?
Well, I mean,
By
first
the
of
way,
all,
let me just say to the audience, you're not going to say that. Eric is a head of the National Brain and Aneurysm Center and the Skull-Base Center in Minneapolis, St. Paul. He's done over 2,800, almost 33,000 aneurysms and bypasses and so forth. So he had a lot of experience. Anyway, so what's your thinking about this? Does this fit what your experience is?
I think it probably is a good fit. I'll preface it by saying that our team, we were early adopters of a multidisciplinary model, which included a group of interventional neuroradiologists to endovascularly treat aneurysms. And we think it's an indispensable aspect of treating some aneurysms. The problem that I've had for many years with the endovascular community, let's say, is that there, and I think that Dr. Tamargo was kind of alluding to this a little bit. There's a little bit of a moving target. So that initially we had bare platinum coils, and when you started to raise concerns about the recurrence rates and their or rebleed rates, so then the idea was, well, now we have coated coils. And then when we started to talk about the fact that the coated coils were failing, well, then they initially had before flow diverting stents, they had other types of stents. So they would do stent assisted coiling, and the idea was that that was going to cure all of these problems because now the stent would eventually prevent recanalization. And then when we started to get good data on, we started using the stent assisted coiling at our center probably in the early 2000s, and by the time we were getting good data and starting to see problems, then flow diverting stents were introduced, in the 2010, 2012 range. And then when we started to see problems with that, we hear about the web. And so there is a moving target aspect to this. And the technology is advancing so quickly that by the time we're getting good long-term data on straight coiling of aneurysms or stent-assisted coiling, that if you present that to an endovascular group, they'll say, well, that doesn't really apply to us anymore because now we have this other technique. And I think that's problematic in terms of being able to present patients with good, legitimate data upon which to base a decision as to what to do. I find it very difficult. I think that you can, in the short term, secure an aneurysm with a web device oftentimes, but we're really comparing very much apples and oranges. And so, I mean, I'm lucky to work with endovascular folks who are pretty open and honest, and it's allowed us to have a balanced practice. But I am concerned about many centers where endovascular has completely supplanted microsurgery, and patients aren't even given the option of microsurgery. And I think the consequence, I'm interested to hear Raphael's take on this, in an academic center where you're training residents, but it's becoming very problematic for younger neurosurgeons to achieve the kind of volumes to become truly proficient in microsurgery. And I worry about a self-fulfilling prophecy where the endovascular work supplants microsurgery simply because of the fact that, without good data, because of what I was mentioning, because of the changing, rapidly evolving technology, there simply isn't enough volume to train young microsurgeons to become proficient. And then if the results are bad, the technology or the techniques are become lost. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Rough. Go ahead,
Yeah,
Rafi.
I agree. I agree. We were very we were early adopters of the technique at Hopkins. As a matter of fact, Hopkins, we were the only center that participated in ISAT in North America, and very early on started seeing the problems. And then as we were starting to see the limits of the coils. Then, as you mentioned, the pipeline was introduced, and then the web was introduced. It,
Can I interrupt you a
it,
minute? What
yeah.
is the web?
So,
For those who don't know, what's a web?
yeah. So the web is a device. You want me to show you a picture of that, or just
Well,
no, no.
if it, you can do it simply fine. If not, well, you can just describe it.
Yeah. So the web. It's like a little sphere or cylinder that is made of interwoven fibers. And let me see if I can show you this picture.
Stands for
No, no.
woven endobridge.
Yeah, it's a woven endobridge. It's like a little, it's like a little sac. And they put it inside the aneurysm. And it pops open, and it comes in two varieties, one that is mostly spherical and the other one that has shoulders.
Okay,
And
don't worry about the picture. You just described it to me. That's good enough.
yeah, and
Don't look.
so
Yeah, go ahead.
and
So
so so so one the pipeline has worked well for sidewall aneurysms, but then people said, we need something for Y bifurcation aneurysms, and the web was supposed to be the solution for that, but it really hasn't worked that well. But
okay.
we pushed at Hopkins. Again, I've had a great group of endovascular colleagues, and whenever they came over and said, we can do this, we can do that, I said, well, let's try it. To the point that we went down to clipping only, treating microsurgically only 20% of the aneurysms. But then, as we've seen the problems, we have stabilized now at about 45% microsurgical and 55% endovascular. And I didn't know exactly where we would fit with other institutions. I thought maybe that because of a referral pattern, we were doing more, but there was a paper that came out a couple of weeks ago. The topic is completely unrelated for that paper. Is whether blood transfusions are helpful after subarachnoid hemorrhage. But the interesting thing about that study is that it involved 23 centers at Canada, the United States, and Australia, and if you look through it. It has the statistics of what percentage of aneurysms were treated endovascularly and microsurgical, and the period is, I believe, 2018 to 2023, and it's 40-60. Again, 40% open and 60% endovascular. So I think the field is maybe stabilizing that, although, like Dr. Nussbaum says, it's worrisome. That some institutions have completely abandoned, microsurgical techniques, and that's a disservice to the patients, because one of the things that I tried to do in the paper was to sort out like which aneurysms are good for endovascular treatment and which ones are good for surgery, and it turns out that of 12 different types of aneurysms, five are good for surgery, five are good for endovascular, and two can be treated either way. Like for instance, anterior communicating artery aneurysms, I don't think are good for endovascular, but they are great for surgery. And the best paper for that, the paper that I quote, is Dr. Nussbaum's paper, that where he showed his series of anterior communicating artery aneurysms, and 96% of his patients went back to doing what they were doing before, and then I think he had a 1% mortality, and 3% maybe didn't have great outcomes. But those are numbers, and the endovascular numbers for anterior communicating artery aneurysms have been much worse than that.
So let me interrupt you for a minute here. So what you've given some really blockbuster statements here. You didn't even put them in your paper. I think you wanted to shield yourself from abuse here. So but anyway, we've agreed that it's very hard to compare clipping with coiling because there's not good follow-up, and as Eric has said, it's the landscape is constantly changing. That's number one. Number two, it looks like, without a question of a doubt, the re-bleeding rate is higher. I mean, that's
Yes.
how you look at it, it's higher.
Yes.
And I'm not even sure that we know the truth, because I'm not sure we're seeing all those. And the other thing you said is the papers are now validating that the pendulum is swinging more to the center, in that there's more people now doing clipping than there used to be. I think it used to be 80-20, you're right.
Right.
And now it's come back to, I'd say, 40-60, or it's getting even better.
Yeah.
And the problem is people don't know how to, they're not trained to clip. I'll tell you what my concern is about the coiling. And that is, initially, neurosurgeons would get an aneurysm and they'd say, well, okay, let's send it over to coiling, or let's send it over interventional. Well, first of all, if they're not part of your team, you'll never see that patient again. And
Yeah.
if they do it, they'll say, oh, it was successful. And I don't think they bring these people back to re-angiogram them. I know when Gerard de Bremen and I were working with it initially with coiling, we brought them back to re-angiogram. Nobody had done that. In fact, it was very hard to find out what the re-bleeding rate was after clipping, because people hadn't done that either.
Right.
And so there is I think it's a very small percentage, but some aneurysms regrow. I think it's less than 8%, or it could be 4%. Maybe you know. So,
No, I don't know. And again, the regrowth rate, then you get into this debate of whether it's significant or not. And that has been a big issue with the endovascular techniques, that there's a remnant or there's a recurrence, and then the question is, well, is it significant? And that's why I personally have settled on the retreatment rate, because when a patient gets retreated, it means that, a lot of people looked at that and said, we're gonna eat crow and take you back to the endovascular suite or surgery. And it means that people were very worried about it. And when you look at the retreatment rates, whether it be coiling, web, or the pipeline, it's 18 to 20% at 10 years.
Okay, so I think what you're telling us is exactly what we're talking about, is that people have been brainwashed to believe that this is the going to be the solution to all problems, and the answer is no, it's not. There is a complication rate, there's a rebleeding rate, there's a regrowth rate, and I'm not sure all that's reported. Whereas in the clipping, I think we've really been held to the fire here to make sure that it's been reported. So, got to be careful about the data, because we're looking at two sets of data. You agree with that, Eric?
I do. I mean, I very much, that's what I was saying. I think you're comparing apples to oranges.
Yeah.
I think that patients need to understand what they're getting, with the differing treatments. And it's important to be able to give them a reasonable expectation of outcomes and whether they're going to need to be retreated. I think there are some kind of tangentially related but important conversations to have. it's less of an issue now with the flow diversion, but certainly I was involved in some controversial conversations when we were talking about coiling aneurysms. I'd be interested to hear what Raphael says, but where we saw some interventional folks taking unruptured aneurysms and coiling off 50%, what they would coil the dome, for example, and 50% of the aneurysm, taking giant aneurysms with clot in them, with the sinking some coils into the clot. You're basically dooming the patient to either needing retreatment or I would think to having it, a false sense of security about what it means to have a partially treated unruptured aneurysm. Certainly, I wouldn't go into a surgery probably for an unruptured aneurysm if I knew that I was going to clip off 40% of the aneurysm. I mean, I think there are rare exceptions, obviously. You might have a situation where you have a very eccentric daughter saccade in the operating room. You found that it was very thin-walled in that part and it was very calcified elsewhere. You made a decision to partially clip that. But in general, again, emphasizing the apples and oranges comparison, there have been traditionally some endovascular practitioners who've been happy to call it 50% treated unruptured ACOM aneurysm a treated aneurysm. And they may not take that patient back. I mean, they may accept that and tell the patient that there's, I used to hear the argument, well, there's scarring within the aneurysm that's going to make it less likely to rebleed. And I'm not sure there's much, if any, data for that. I mean, I worry about a 40% or 50% coiled aneurysm potentially, at least initially, being less stable. I mean, you may be redirecting the flow in a way that you don't want to redirect it.
Yeah, when I was at UCLA, and they had a good paper. I'm not here to indict them. That's not the point. But they developed partial coiling, just what you said. They had a ruptured aneurysm. They didn't have time to do it. It was the interventionalist trying to do something, so that before the surgeon got there, and we'll partially coil it. And I didn't like that at all because I had the same concerns you did. They reported well. They didn't rebleed. I'm not so. I just don't like that. Looking at aneurysms and treating them surgically, partially coiling them, that doesn't make me feel very comfortable. What do you think about that? You wrote a little bit in your paper about that.
Oh, I agree. It's very concerning. I think you have to, and again, at this point, we have been talking about the limitations of endovascular. But then on the other hand, there's some aneurysms that, particularly with the pipeline, are being treated very well. Like for example, clinoidal aneurysms, ophthalmic aneurysms, superior hypophyseals. I published a paper that, with clinoidal aneurysms, we had, particularly where we had to drill the clinoid or remove the clinoid, we had a 30% visual problem rate. Not necessarily blindness, but the patients were not the same. And then with endovascular techniques, those are responding well. But again, partially treated aneurysms are very worrisome. And like Eric was saying, we don't go into surgery saying we're going to partially clip this aneurysm. Sometimes it may happen, but it's very rare and it's not a planned event.
We'll get into the specific aneurysms in a minute. I wanted to ask you one more general question, and it was in your paper, and that is, there are two things we all grew up with. One is, what was the rupture rate? And two is a study that came out of the Mayo Clinic, which said that aneurysms didn't rupture below 10 millimeters, then they made 7 millimeters, and then that was wrong. So there are two questions. One is what is the rupture rate of an aneurysm? I know there are many factors in it. Long term, I got a 30-year-old in front of me. Is it 1% a year? And what's the cumulative rate? I've got a 50-year-old or 55-year-old. What's the cumulative rate? What would you give me a so everybody knows what the general parameters are?
So the best statistics for that are number one, the Jubella paper, Because you know, in Finland, they you know, Finland is a country of about 5 million people, 5, 6 million people, and they're very happy there. You know, they don't want to leave, but people don't want to go live in Finland. Well, until recently, but they had a captive audience, and at one point, you know, about 40 years ago or whatever, they made a decision that they were not going to treat unruptured aneurysm. So they did a prospective observational study for the rest of the world, and their rate was essentially 1% per year. And then there was a Japanese study, the JUCAS, the Japanese unruptured cerebral aneurysm study, and that study was not prospective, but it's a huge study, and they came out with the same number. So basically, the rate is 1% per year for rupture, and then
For
and it,
unruptured.
yeah, for unruptured aneurysm,
Okay,
and
now.
yeah, 1% per year. And then to translate into a patient, roughly speaking, if you have someone sitting in front of you know, a 50-year-old, that person has, you know, assuming it's a male, it's about 30 years of life, 30 years of life. And you know, it's not exactly right, but you can assume that it's going to be like 30%, the number of years left to live. Every year that the 1% gets a little lower, but it doesn't get much lower. So it's about, you know, it's about the amount of time that people have left to live actuarially, and that is the risk of rupture over their lifetime.
Now, I'm sure you're going to agree with this, and so will Eric, but now the aneurysm is not small. It's 5 millimeters. It's multi-lobed,
Yeah.
and it doesn't look very good, and so forth. That you can't compare that. That doesn't fall in the same category as the one you just described.
That's right. That's right. Because then that paper from Mayo Clinic was wrong. I mean, you know, that basically they said 10 millimeters, and then someone said 7 millimeters, and everybody said, well, that cannot be right because the aneurysms that we're treating are less than that. And then David Weaver from Mayo said, well, you know, the reason is that when the aneurysms rupture, they collapse and they seem smaller, but they, you know, they were actually bigger. But then Brian Ho published a really fascinating paper where patients had had an angiogram. They were waiting to have a procedure, and then they ruptured, so they could compare the aneurysms before. And it turns out that this thing that they were bigger and they collapse and are smaller is not true at all. If anything, they remain the same size or they get bigger. And we looked at that, and over time, the size of the ruptured aneurysms has decreased. And at this point, you know, we published a paper that for us, the average size of a ruptured aneurysm is 5 millimeters, 5 millimeters. But
Eric, what's your experience?
Yeah, I mean, the Mayo Clinic study, it's a funny thing. I think that there were some positives that came out of that study because, for example, I remember when I was a resident, if you were found to have an aneurysm, it was treated. And, there were some people in their 80s who were found to have unruptured aneurysms, and they were treated and probably treated unnecessarily, and some of those patients were probably hurt. And that was just the thinking back at the time. And I think it made us a little more conservative. But I'll share with you a personal anecdote about that study. So University of Minnesota was a participating center. It was really previously under Roberto Herros mostly, but I after he was there, Paul Camerota was there, I inherited that, that position. And so in the late 90s, when the unruptured aneurysm study came out, I went to one of the meetings representing the University of Minnesota where all the neurosurgeons from centers who participated were there. And Dave Weber's was up at the front of the room. And members from the audience were allowed to ask questions. And so I actually was kind of young and a little bit brash. And I stood up and I said, I'd like to take a poll in the room. For all the neurosurgeons here, If you yourself were found to have a 5 millimeter posterior communicating artery aneurysm, would you have it treated, or would you, or do you believe this data? And literally every hand basically in the room went up that they would have it treated. Weber's was beside himself, and I don't think I was invited back, to the next meeting.
I've had that
But
experience.
I don't, I think sophisticated vascular neurosurgeons have not really accepted that, that data. Probably the cavernous aneurysms, they were right. They're very, very benign. And if they do bleed, it's not particularly dangerous. But yeah, I think it's the other thing is, and I tell this to patients, patients come and see me and they have, for example, a 6 millimeter aneurysm, and they'll tell me that they were counseled by another neurosurgeon that until it's 7 millimeters, they don't have to worry about it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I just tell them, look, biologically, I don't understand why anyone would think that a 6 millimeter aneurysm is fundamentally different from a 7 millimeter aneurysm. I mean, if you're going to tell me a 1 millimeter aneurysm, I accept that. It could, or it could be a bump on the vessel, it could be an irregularity, or even a 2 or 2.5 millimeter aneurysm. But you're going to really tell me that the body is no, that there's a fundamental scientific difference between a 6.5 millimeter or a 6.9 millimeter aneurysm and a 7.1 millimeter aneurysm. That just doesn't make sense. And I, our experience, of course, is that the majority of aneurysms that present with rupture are under 10 millimeters and probably 7 millimeters or under, because they're the overwhelming majority of aneurysms. So to suggest to someone that it's safe, I mean, and they don't have to worry about it, I think is a disservice.
I think let's so at this point we'll go into the specific aneurysms in just a second here, but just summarizing what we've agreed here is that comparing clipping and coiling is like comparing apples and oranges. You can't do that. But we know, I think, from all the evidence that you presented one way or the other, and that's in your paper, that there is a higher rate of rebleeding with coiling than there is with clipping. And whether it's acknowledged or not, at least in multiple studies, at least lead you to say that. And then the last statistics you just gave us, Rafael, is that it looks like we're shifting from we're shifting from a period of can't do this. We're shifting from a period of going to dominant coil dominant and interventional back to more of an equal share between the two. And then what you just talked about is what the rupture rate is just on an unruptured aneurysm. Turns out to be about 1% per year. And now if we get into an aneurysm that's got multi-lobed and it's a different shape and so forth and so on and size, then all those statistics become different. And there was a study, I think, in Finland. They did great studies, which I think Ernest Niemi was involved with, where they tried to find out which aneurysms would rupture. And they went and they re-angiogram people. And they found the ones that were growing was the ones that were going to grow, and then they operated on those. And I cite that literature correctly?
Yes.
Huh? So, and I think the Japanese are now trying to use molecular means of uptake of various it's macrophage substances that show up on imaging to show if they. If the aneurysm is growing, or if there's more macrophages, which means the vessel wall is less muscle and so forth. But I'm not sure that's reached a level where they can use that as a determinant. Am I right
Well,
about that?
it hasn't. It hasn't. Yeah.
Okay. So we're still left with what we did before. So let's go unless you let's go into the individual aneurysm. So the location. Let's take, and I think you're right. Let's start with right up the carotid artery. Let's go to the aneurysm. You just mentioned it a few minutes ago. Aneurysm right at the clinoid, right at the origin of the ophthalmic artery. In the past, we used to drill off the clinoid and do things like that. I remember Gerard de Brun, who is a great interventionalist, came up and And he could coil that far better than I could get through doing surgery on those, which is kind of what you just said. How would you treat those?
Yeah, I think cavernous, clinoidal, ophthalmic segments, superior hypophyseal segment aneurysms are great for endovascular treatment, particularly in the pipeline. And people may or may not throw a few coils in there, but they do very well with pipeline. So, cavernous, clinoidal, ophthalmic, and superior hypophyseals.
Do you agree, Eric?
For the most part, that's the direction that we've taken. I mean, I always found removing the clinoid next to a large aneurysm to be a somewhat stressful experience. We did it very
I
often,
agree
but I
with
didn't
that.
love it. I really embraced the use of the Sonopet early on
Yes,
and
yes.
found that that made me a lot happier than having a drill rotating at 70,000 RPMs next to that
Right.
aneurysm. I think the exception. The rare exceptions are we've had some patients with significant visual loss from larger aneurysms where I felt that previously when they were going to be filling it with coils, even though there's some evidence that with a cranial nerve that the mass effect will subside, subsides over time. There were times with significant visual loss where I've been happier with the idea of actually being able to decompress the aneurysm sac. And alternatively, almost paradoxically, very small ophthalmic aneurysms, which often have the ophthalmic artery incorporated into the base, I've continued sometimes to treat surgically, where, especially for the unruptured ones, where you can remove the clinoid. It's not particularly stressful. I don't find, I'm not worried about rupturing the aneurysm. And then you can kind of lift the optic nerve and pretty easily put a clip underneath and treat that kind of broad-based aneurysm. But I agree, in general, that aneurysm is well treated endovascularly.
Okay, let's go to the posterior communicating.
So posterior communicating and anterior choroidals can go either way. I think they're they're straightforward to clip, but also they're straightforward for them. Now, there are a couple of caveats. Again, as Eric was saying, if there's an artery that is coming out of the base of the aneurysm, that aneurysm is better for clipping. There's one situation where I think with posterior communicating artery aneurysm that is clearly indicated to do surgery, and that is when the patients present with a third nerve palsy. If the aneurysm is pressing on the third nerve, you get faster and more complete resolution of the third nerve if you decompress the third nerve with clipping, clip and then rupture the, drain the sac. Than if you perpetuate the mass effect with the coils.
Right, we used to the aneurysms that are easy to coil or easy to clip, and so that would be you could say go either way. I think it's clippable. You can see what you're doing, and that's that could be done. Now let's go to the carotid bifurcation.
So carotid
That?
bifurcation, I think is better for surgery. That's the aneurysm that the web was developed for, for that ambassador. And but the results have not been great with that. And again, this is an aneurysm that is very, very well treated surgically. So I think the carotid termination is better for surgery.
Eric, what do you think?
I like operating on carotid bifurcation aneurysms. I think that when they get large, it's hard. The perforators can be difficult. I think certainly endovascular has done a lot of those. They like the bifurcation aneurysms. I'm happy to operate on them. I think it's we have it as split, pretty split in our practice.
For me, the most difficult thing about those aneurysms are the perforators off the back.
Yes.
Small little head perforators that go into the lenticulostriate vessels, and so we used to have an approach where we didn't look at it head on. We came down the middle cerebral artery, so you could look at the back and the front at the same time, and put a cotton ball and move those perforators out of the way, and then you can clip the aneurysm at least without having that as a problem. It's kind of like the basilar tip. but you can see
Yeah.
it better. And I agree with you about that. Middle cerebral, what would you do with that?
I de definitely surgery. I think those aneurysms are they're actually very tricky. Often broad-based, and they have weird configurations. And I think it's really advantageous to be able to look at them, and they can require pretty creative clip configurations, but I think they're better treated with surgery.
How about you, Eric?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you, I remember 20 years ago, 15, maybe 15 years ago, Roberto Harris giving a talk where he said, we're all becoming expert middle cerebral artery aneurysm surgeons. And I mean, there's no question that a larger percentage of my practice over the years has become middle cerebral artery aneurysms because they're so well treated surgically in general. I mean, obviously, there's rare exceptions, but it's easy to get proximal control for the most part if you need it. You can open the middle cere, you can open the Sylvian fissure, to the degree that you need to expose the aneurysm often circumferentially, get a good look at it from all vantage points. And I think, as was said, they often incorporate those M2 branches. They're often very irregular, and it's reassuring to be able to reconstruct those with clips. And a number of a relatively high percentage of the redo previously treated endovascular cases that I've done have been middle cerebral aneurysms. They tend to fail in a more dramatic way endovascularly, and I think you can understand why based on the configuration. So I totally agree.
Terrific discussion. Okay, anterior communicating. Let's leave anyone out, but anterior communicating. What looks
I
that?
think that's better for surgery also. You know, that's an interesting one because initially my endovascular colleagues started putting coils into them, but then the recurrence rate was very, very high. And we went to a point where they were using the H construct, which was they would put coils into the anterior communicating aneurysm, then it would recur. They would put a pipeline on one side and then a pipeline on the other, and that turned out to be a catastrophic treatment. And I think they're very difficult to treat well endovascularly. A lot of the aneurysms that I've had to retreat after being previously coiled have been ACOM. So I favor surgery for that.
Your view, Eric?
I like surgery. I think that there are ACOM. You said it, Dr. Ausman, you said it yourself. The aneurysms that are easy to treat surgically are often easy to treat endovascularly. The aneurysms that are more difficult, period, can be difficult for either of discipline. But I think those aneurysms are often better treated surgically, and I include a lot of the ACOM aneurysms there. I think the only thing you have to be careful about is that I do think you have to be a better surgeon to do a good job with the intercommunicating aneurysms.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's true, but yet, you don't want to go out and just like have neuros give neurosurgeons blanket give all neurosurgeons blanket whatever to go clip ACOM aneurysms are more tricky. You must see the full anatomy. You have to see the perforators. You have to see the opposite A2. I've seen an unfortunate number of cases where someone's gone in and managed to clip off the. In fact, I just operated a few weeks ago on a patient that years ago had been operated where the opposite A2 was sacrificed along with it. But I also agree, you can see the gymnastics that the endovascular guides go to sometimes to treat an aneurysm. You see that a lot with the ACOM aneurysm. I remember a lot of times they would coil the aneurysm and they would coil back into the ACOM and sacrifice the ACOM, and they would say, well, there's good A1s on both sides, so what's the difference? I mean, and I would sit there thinking, well, we take it pretty seriously. We see some perforators off of the ACOM itself, off the back. I wouldn't want to lose those,
Yeah.
so I There are cases, the ones that are pointing up and back, I think are harder for us surgically. If it's going to be hidden by the A2s, it can be more challenging. But it's a good surgical aneurysm in the hands of a good surgeon.
Okay, so let's go to the posterior circulation. Let's do, we'll only do three. Pica. Pica aneurysm ruptured.
Yeah, so pica, I think is still better treated surgically. It turns out that most pica origin aneurysms involve the pica, and I think again, if you do a good operation and that entails doing a far lateral, in my opinion, doing a far lateral transcondylar procedure. If you just do a craniectomy and don't remove the foramen magnum or do anything else, it's a reach. But if you do a suboccipital craniectomy, remove the foramen magnum, and then remove the part of the one third of the condyle, then it becomes a very good aneurysm to treat surgically.
Eric, you worked with Charlie Drake for a while, so you had some experience there. What's your approach to that aneurysm?
I mean, I do them exactly that way. Far lateral suboccipital approach is I think by far preferential. I mean, we also the other aneurysm along the pica is, the dissecting aneurysm. We see a lot of pica dissections. I see a lot of them because I wrote about that and talked about that a lot, and I get that patient those patients sent to me. That's a surgical lesion from my perspective. I've seen a lot of endovascular cases where they've sacrificed the pica intentionally for that lesion, and it bothers me. I think we have good options for that. And so I think pica is a good surgical aneurysm. Like all endovascular cases, if the patient's in really poor grade, if it's a really bad hemorrhage, and I don't have a problem with treating it endovascularly, but we do a good job with it.
Of course, yes.
Okay, let's, what about the vertebral basilar junction?
I think that those aneurysms tend to be fusiform often, or they have I prefer to have them treated endovascularly, the vertebral basilar junction.
Eric, what's your thought?
So, I mean, by way of disclosure, Dr. Drake liked that aneurysm. I've only operated a few of them. I find it a very stressful aneurysm to operate. I mean, ruptured. Unruptured, you can if you can get there and it's not so bad. Anecdotally, I was operating on a ruptured VB junction aneurysm that was directed. They're often associated with a fenestration. I'm sure you know that. Which so you have to get that anatomy. This one with the one I'm recalling was from a few years ago. It was directed back in towards the brainstem. As soon as I started to suction away clot, the aneurysm ruptured. I put a temporary clip on the ipsilateral larger vertebral artery, which was exposed. It didn't slow it down. I put a clip on the contralateral vertebral artery. It didn't slow it down. At least it didn't feel like it. I somehow got a clip up on the basilar distal to the aneurysm. Obviously, it stopped it at that point. By that point, I started to have, I thought I was having pain in my left arm. I was wondering if it was chest pain. I think it was because of the awkward angle and my neck was. So I don't love that aneurysm just because I find working that far past those lower cranial nerves, especially in a ruptured setting, gives me stress. But yeah, I like endovascularly is fine with me for that aneurysm. If they tell me they can't do it, I'll do it.
Okay, good. One last aneurysm, and that's a basilar tip. I mean, obviously, I'm leaving out the small minority, but basilar tip. Raphael, what's the story?
So the basilar tip, I mean, that's an operation that I love, but I have gone to a endovascular treatment first for those aneurysms. And the reason for that is that, whereas with other aneurysms, I noticed that the vast majority of my patients would go back to doing what they were doing before. I'm talking about unruptured patients. With unruptured basilars, I noticed that 15 to 20% of patients had some level of cognitive dysfunction, and I was very distraught by that. And they didn't really have a stroke, and they didn't have anything. But I think that it's so much surgery that it caused a problem. So I called Duke Sampson and Hunt Bajer about it, and they said no, we see the same thing that that those patients are. They have a high incidence of cognitive issues. So I think that I don't feel as strongly as, for example, a basilar trunk aneurysm treating endovascularly. I would say that for instance, if you have small broad-based basilar aneurysms, that's good for surgery. If you have a small neck aneurysm, if I think it's reasonable to treat it endovascularly.
Eric, what's your thought?
It's a tough aneurysm. I think probably the three of us have all operated on a fair number of upper basilar aneurysms. I certainly differentiate a superior cerebellar aneurysm, which I think is easily and well treated surgically with very low risk, from a true basilar tip aneurysm,
Right.
where, in my experience, I operated a fair number early on in my career, above 10 millimeters. Not that it's a magic number. I struggled more, with the exposure of all the perforators. I did a lot. I did them more through a subtemporal approach, as Dr. Drake did, and I like that better. I was always uncomfortable with the perioral or the half-half. Getting the half, I guess, gives you a little bit of both, but I felt better about getting the exposure of the perforators with the subtemporal, but oftentimes seeing that opposite P1, feeling totally comfortable with it. At our center, the basilar tip aneurysms is a endovascular first aneurysm. And if they feel for some reason that they are not going to be able to treat it, and I do treat some of the failures, the endovascular failures, but it's more often a bypass type of situation where we're going to do an upper basilar occlusion and bypass to the superior cerebellar or the P1, or, well, not P, P2, P3. That type of thing is more surgical. I don't directly clip that many basilar tip aneurysms. I mean, it's just the truth. We don't do that many anymore. The really small narrow necked ones, I think are pretty well treated. But there's a fair amount of variability in terms of the anatomy. And I mean, sometimes it's not always that easy to predict. Sometimes you can look at the Dr. Drake spent a lot. You can look at where the basilar apex is relative to the clinoids, but then you put in a lumbar drain and it can kind of dip down, I find. And so sometimes if you get a really good look, it's fine. Sometimes it's really tight and really hard to see, and it can be difficult to get a clip on the upper basilar if you want a temporary clip. So I think it's a good endovascular aneurysm for the most part. The bigger ones are hard either way. Really difficult to control that aneurysm. So.
For me, the most challenging part of that aneurysm is the perforators, and we've all operated on them. And you get some perforator in the clip, and the patient has a deficit. You're devastated. The patient's devastated, and so you try to avoid doing that. And so I didn't like that very much, and I thought endovascular had a better approach than I did. I remember what was Christmas Eve or something. We were operating on a man who came in with a big, giant basilar aneurysm. And we took him down to the operating room. I looked at the thing, and I said, "There's no way I'm going to put a clip around this thing, or deflate it and put a clip around it and avoid the perforator." So I called Gerard, and he came in the night. I said, "Gerard, I want you to look at this because you're going to have to coil this because I'm not going to operate on this patient. I'll kill him." And I think it depends upon. I've seen the people devastated by those perforators being taken, and we've all been through that. But so I'd agree with you, Raphael, and with Eric. I think it'd probably be interventional first. So we've gone through the spectrum. Let me ask you a couple of other things, because I think we've done pretty well here. The one of the problems we're looking at And you mentioned that earlier on, both you and Raphael did, Eric. And that is, we're getting surgeons who have less and less experience with this. And if that's true, and we're now getting more and more aneurysms that should go to surgery, how are we going to do this?
Well, I think that the clipping of aneurysms for a while was in the 60s and 70s was something that was done in tertiary care centers, and then people came out and it became a widely done technique. But I think now it's being reconcentrated into the centers. It turns out there are only 11 centers in the country that are approved for CREST, not CREST, CAST fellowships for open surgery. So I think it may be of benefit for them to be reconcentrated at high volume centers.
Any thoughts about that, Eric?
You know what? I mean, obviously preaching to the choir. I mean, my whole career I've talked about this. I have a lot of issue with with the idea of the old-fashioned idea of the generalist neurosurgeon who does everything. I understand it, I appreciate it. I think that it's a tough operation, and it should be done at centers that do higher volumes and by people who have the expertise. And I think that that's what it's going to take. I think the challenge is that because endovascular, I think it's easier to do endovascular, and I think that that's what we saw happen, at least in the upper Midwest over the years, was that there was a period early in my career where nobody wanted to clip aneurysms, and there weren't really coiling that many aneurysms, so everything got sent in to, to our center. And then we reached a point where many of the smaller hospitals in smaller towns had someone, often a neurologist, for example, who had been done a short endovascular fellowship, and all of a sudden they have someone coiling aneurysms, and they might only coil three or four or five a year, but they wouldn't send them. And then what would be sent, we would get the patient sent a few days after they'd been coiled, because they'd have one person working at this hospital, and then they would be off for the weekend, and the patient would need an intervention for vasospasm, and they would funnel the patient to our center to have the treatment done, and then we would see the results of what they did, and sometimes it was good, but sometimes it wasn't good. So I really think that it's more than just having open surgery concentrated in larger centers. I don't know how you do this, but a multidisciplinary situation in order to treat these cases. And so getting those patients in general, whether they're going to be treated endovascularly or with open surgery, back to the big centers is, I think, what it's going to take. I mean, somehow we've managed to regionalize trauma into level one trauma centers, level two, level three. I don't know why we don't do this for aneurysms.
Interesting. Now you touched on one other subject, and that is we've got a third of our viewers are from North America or USA, and the rest of them, the other two-thirds, are from around the world. And most of those places, intervention is too costly, the coils are too costly, the equipment's too costly. And so, as Juha did, her and Esnimi went around the world talking about how you can do these surgically, and you could do them skin to skin. I mean, he did I don't know, thousands of them in an hour, and we have some videotapes showing that. And you and I talked to him, Eric, and so for the parts of the world where they don't have this, surgery still can be done. It can be done well. It can be done carefully, and you have clips and so forth. It'll be a while before intervention comes there, and when it comes there, it probably won't be as highly received as it was here. You guys have any thoughts about that, Raphael?
I think that continuing to treat aneurysms surgically is very reasonable. And again, in people who want to concentrate on doing them, Again, here in the United States, we have the opportunity to select patients because we have specialists near each other. But I think that they're very good options for surgical options for most aneurysms.
Eric, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, just I think that this is not meaning to be critical of any different, the way different people do it, but I think that sometimes when people from outside of the United States, especially third world countries where they don't have a lot of resources, they'll come and visit. And depending on where they visit can have a big impact on what they take away. There are centers. Nothing wrong with this, that all the aneurysms have a lot of intensive neurophysiologic monitoring. And the case, an aneurysm can be a 12-hour case. I'm not critical. It takes as long as it takes. And if the results are good, the results are good. That's not just the way that I was trained, I think, the average unruptured aneurysm takes, I'm not as quick as Dr. Hernes-Yemi, but it takes about an hour and a half. Or 2 hours, if I'm going to occlude a vessel intentionally, I mean, I'll use monitoring. I don't personally use electrophysiologic monitoring otherwise. I don't think it has to be that complicated. And I think the point you're raising is very important, which is that, we send, we've sent a lot of clips, older clips, out to out to sub-Saharan Africa, that type of thing. They can do that operation very well. And if they don't have the resources, if they don't have a biplane angiography suite and they don't have the coils and the technology, then they can treat those patients very effectively with surgery.
Avail, any thoughts?
I agree. I agree completely that basically they, if people want to concentrate on treating aneurysms surgically, they're very good options for them in most third world countries.
Well, we could go on for a long time. There are a lot of things to discuss. What is practice going to evolve to in the next 25, 30 years? I don't think it's going to look anything like it did now, and so forth. How you should develop centers, what's that going to do to the people in private practice? A lot of things to discuss, but I think we'll stop here. Raphael, you stimulated this discussion, which I think is terrific. You see, we don't need the slides. What we need to do is
I'm
all you
glad.
have to do is bring your brain and your experience, and you can communicate that beautifully, and you did.
Thank you.
Eric, I thank you. Any thoughts any of you have last before we close up?
No, I just want to thank you, Jim, for the opportunity to participate in this. It's been great. I've loved spending time with you and Eric and discussing these issues.
Okay, Eric, any thoughts?
Look, my pleasure. Two wonderful people to spend an hour and a half with. I guess, regarding the treatment of aneurysms, I mean, I would again emphasize that, when you talk about comparing results with open surgery and endovascular, I think it's important to get that data. Like, this is really important data because there's not good, oftentimes not good data out there. But I guess I always fall back to my own personal position, which is that if it's done well, it's not a competition. And I know that, I mean, that's basically what we're all saying. But there are cases that are better done endovascularly and cases that are better done microsurgically. If your name is Charlie Drake or, then you're probably going to, his results with unruptured basilar tip aneurysms beat any endovascular practitioner alive today, from my perspective. I mean, towards the later part of his career, he had a 1% complication rate for his unruptured basilar apex aneurysms. I mean, it was astounding. Now, nobody, I mean, maybe someone will come along, but I don't think anyone will replicate that. But the point is that, we're all, nobody likes to think of the fact that we're not cogs in a wheel, we're not interchangeable, we're different. Dr. Jim, you did some bypasses with the superior cerebellar and the AICA that The AI in particular, I can't do. I tried. I can, you know, and that's just the way it is. And I've done a lot of bypass work. So there's going to be, you know, there's going to be situations where if you're the neurosurgeon or if Raphael's the neurosurgeon, you know, it may tip a little bit one way for a particular aneurysm or more towards endovascular for another. And that's really the art, you know, the why this is an art and not a science. But it only works if you're in a multidisciplinary team where you have good surgery and good endovascular and honest look at the results, people keeping each other honest. Where we get in trouble, I said this before, but I guess it's not too common to have a pure open microsurgery center, but I really don't like these, you know, all endovascular centers where nurse where open surgery has been for, you know, fallen by the wayside, I think is a problem for the patient.
Okay, good, very good. Lots of good wisdom today, and I really appreciate it. You guys did great, and I think the audience is going to appreciate it. They're going to get a frank discussion of a common problem. And Raphael, you got to think about writing a paper on what we started out with is what is the real problem? How do we compare these statistics, and what is the truth? And it would be a wake-up paper. We'll publish it on in SNI if nobody else will, but I'll tell you, because there's a lot of myth going out there and not a lot of facts.
Okay, yeah,
And
that's a
it's
good
supported by
idea.
industry, which wants you to coil.
Yeah.
All right, take care and thank you both very much. Okay?
Thank you. Good
Thank
night,
you so
Jim.
much.
Good night, Eric. Bye.
There are key references and charts associated with this talk. We suggest that you take screenshots for your records and for further information in the future. This is the paper from which Dr. Tamargo made his presentation. It has 144 references published in an Operative Neurosurgery in November of 2024. And these are the books of Dr. Tamargo on intracranial aneurysm surgery and AVMs, available at Amazon.com or Theme.com. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the author, interviewees, and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of SNI Digital or its management. The information contained in this program should not be considered to be medical advice. Patients should consult their own physicians for that advice as to their specific medical needs. Please fill out your evaluation of this video. You'll see a rating scale beneath the main video on the home page. And it has 5 stars. Choose from 1 to 5 stars, 5 being the best to help us improve the information we bring to you in SNI Digital. The foundation supporting these journals believes there are many ways to learn. One publication, SNI, or Surgical Neurology International, is a 2D internet journal with Nancy Epstein, its editor-in-chief. Second publication is SNI Digital, which is a complete video publication, Innovations in Learning, a 3D video journal, interactive with discussion. Its web address is snidigital.org. The web address of S Surgical Neurology International is sni.global. Both are free 24/7, 365 on the internet. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. After 15 years of publication, it has the third largest readership of neurosurgery journals in the world. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is viewed in 149 countries in the 12 months since it's been published, the first video journal and the first video journal of neurosurgery. Foundation supporting these programs is devoted to helping people throughout the world. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. There is an icon which you can visualize in this diagram, a blue icon at the bottom right of the home page of SNI Digital, which you can click, and if you have questions, comments, or requests for CME credit. SNI Digital is now offering this program on podcasts on Apple, Amazon, and Spotify. Look under SNI Digital in those podcasts. And the foundation supports the Medical News Network, bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. This program is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. All rights are reserved. Contact James Ausman at the email address listed if you have further questions. Thank you for watching the program. We hope it's been enjoyable.